I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Call me Snake.
The blackest eyes. The devil's eyes. Purely and simply evil.
You're out of your
mind, Wayne.
God bless you.
What do we do?
Hello out there and welcome back to Precinct 13, a podcast about the movies, music, and mind of John Carpenter. My name is Nick Rocco Scalia, one of your two co-hosts, joined as always by your other co-host, Christopher Oliphant. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. I'm wearing my blue suede shoes and I've got my gold sunglasses on. My hair is up in a pompadour, and today we are talking about Elvis.
Wow, yeah, and not John Carpenter's Elvis.
No, we're just completely shifting the format of the podcast. We're only going to talk about Elvis Presley from here on out. I lied when I said this was the movie's music and mind of John Carpenter. It is strictly the music of Elvis Presley.
Right, I was just pointing out the fact that this movie does not have the John Carpenters in front of it before Elvis. It
oh, you is mean simply we're not Elvis. Doing an Elvis podcast now? That's a bummer. I was so excited for that.
Yeah, Elvis, this one is crazy, right? This is like a made-for-television biographical film. How did this thing come to be? Like, what have you learned about this movie since seeing it?
You know, looking into the history of this movie, it's kind of fascinating. Like, it just sort of came at this time in John Carpenter's career when he was starting to get a little bit of clout in the industry. And one thing that he said about it is he wanted to do a dramatic film, and he had never really done just a straight drama before. And he was interested in, you know, just some of the directorial stuff that goes into that. I mean, there's some great character scenes in movies like Halloween and Precinct 13. But he wanted to just kind of go for broke with that. He wanted to make a strictly dramatic film that was not a genre piece. And the other thing I read that was kind of interesting is the producers of this chose him basically because they had heard he recorded the score for Halloween. He was a composer and a musician, which we've talked about a lot on the show. And so I guess they just assumed, okay, this guy knows a little bit about music. He can make a movie about the king of rock and roll, about like one of the great pop music artists of all time. It's kind of a tenuous connection there, but I think it worked out pretty well.
I know. I'm just imagining some producer like watching the movie Halloween and being like, wait a minute, the director did the music for this? Sign him up for Elvis.
Yeah, right.
yeah, incredible. And this movie is not the easiest to get your hands on, but again, 1979, and following Someone's Watching Me, just to kind of recap there, we've done Dark Star, Precinct 13, I should say Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, Someone's Watching Me, which was a TV movie, and then Elvis, which is another TV movie. And this also wraps up the decade of the 1970s for John Carpenter films. And I would like to mention right off the bat, as I am completely taking this off Wikipedia because I knew I wouldn't remember without looking, but apparently this Elvis film was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for Best Motion Picture Made for Television, 3 Primetime Emmy Awards, including Outstanding Lead Actor in a Miniseries or a Movie, for who?
Mr. Kurt Russell. This is the start of an incredible partnership. He didn't win that Emmy. He was nominated for it. As I think we'll get into on the show today, I think he really deserved it. I think he definitely should have gotten some awards attention for this. But this is really an outlier in the Carpenter filmography, and we've been sort of going through the film step by step. Just a little note there. So basically in his production chronology, he makes this right after Halloween. Someone's Watching Me, his other TV film from the 70s, was made before Halloween and debuted a week after that premiered in theaters. So
correct.
There, you know, there's some little wrinkles in the timeline there, but yeah, this is his last movie of the 70s, and it's his last TV movie for a while. So I think we should maybe get into it. It runs 2 hours and 50 minutes, I want to say.
This is a long movie.
Yeah, it's 10 minutes shy of the original Godfather. So we've got a lot to talk about. I'm looking forward to doing that. We will be right back with our discussion of John Carpenter's Elvis.
Tonight, a special presentation of the ABC Sunday Night Movie. To millions, he was the king. Elvis Aaron Presley.
Hey, kid, this is Sam Phillips. Listen, you want to come make some blues?
The greatest entertainer of the 20th century. Tonight, meet the man who became the legend.
All right, we are back. Elvis is back in the building. Chris, where do you want to lead off with this? There is, like you said before, there's so much to talk about. This is one of the, like, I want to say this is the longest movie in the Carpenter filmography.
Oh, it's definitely the longest movie in the Carpenter filmography. I guess I would just start off by saying we have an electrifying performance here by Kurt Russell. It doesn't matter if you are an Elvis fan or not. I think he kind of embodies the character to a level that is extremely impressive. And the other thing that I have to say about it is just that, yeah, as we go down, I should say, as we go through Carpenter's career, this is kind of one of the weirdest choices, I think. I mean, you look at all his movies and you go, oh, yeah, you know, here he did The Thing, and there he does Prince of Darkness and Halloween, and oh, he did Mouth of Madness, and you go, Elvis? It's like really a, it sticks out as being, it's like the most un-Carpenter film, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that statement. I mean, there's a couple of things here that you don't really see anywhere else in the Carpenter filmography. I mean, I called it an outlier, and it is in so many ways, but Chris, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, there are a few films that I haven't seen, but I feel like I have a pretty good sense of what they are and what they're about. Carpenter has never done a movie that spanned decades like this before, right?
No.
Maybe the time jump in Halloween from the early scenes of young Michael Myers murdering his sister, and then we come back, what, like 15 years later or something like that? Like, that's a pretty good time jump. But this is a film where we basically see Elvis's entire life, almost up until, like, they don't get into his sort of decline and his death, but this came out a couple of years after that happened, so I'm assuming they kind of just didn't want to open up that sort of fresh wound there. But we see him basically from his childhood to his middle age, and from his teenage years to the end of the film. He's played by Kurt Russell, but I don't think we get another film like that ever in the Carpenter filmography, where he's basically spanning almost an entire life. And the other thing is, he's not a filmmaker who generally works with true stories or inspired by a true story kind of films. This is the only biopic, I think, as far as I know.
No, I think you're actually correct on both fronts. I can't think of any other movie that he's made that, you know, spans the course of decades or is made in the biopic style. And you also brought up another important point, which is that, I mean, 1979, this thing comes out, it's broadcast on ABC just 2 years after the king himself died. So I'm sure at the time this was something that attracted a lot of eyeballs. And it's really the first time that John Carpenter and Kurt Russell worked together, which of course ended up becoming like a saga of movies that they did together, which I love so much, because who doesn't love Kurt Russell? I mean, seriously, it's such a wonderful thing to have him along for the journey that was the film career of John Carpenter. But man, it's like watching this movie. I mean, Nick, what was your, this is what I want to know. What were your, not only your first impressions, but what were your expectations going into this? I mean, you must have been like, I mean, at this point, you know, you've seen the first five films. You must have been saying to yourself, what is this going to be all about?
Well, I mean, I think by this point in Carpenter's career, he establishes a real credibility as a filmmaker. You know, he's not one of those people that's a one-trick pony, and I think we know that even from the early stuff, right? I mean, starting with Dark Star, which is this sci-fi satire thing. I mean, he's got a gift for comedy. Obviously, we know, you know, the successes he had in the horror genre before this. There's some really fascinating stuff in Assault on Precinct 13, just as far as techniques and the way he plays with genre a little bit there. Like, that's a little bit of a horror film. It's mostly an action film, that confined location thing. So, I mean, the guy just has like a breadth of talent at this point that, you know, I guess you could sort of apply to almost anything. The question I had, though, was, one, this being a television movie, you know, how much of Elvis's story could you actually tell in a film that has to meet the requirements of network television? And the budget for this was not very high for a film this long. The fascinating statistic that I read, I still don't know how they did this. This movie was shot in 30 days. And as I was saying, it takes place over several decades. It spans a lot of different locations. I mean, it's not the most extravagant looking movie. I mean, you can tell. I mean, we're talking about Elvis Presley here, right? So the crowd scenes should be huge, and there's no huge crowd scenes here at all. You know, most of the performances are shot kind of in like medium shots and close up. We don't get a lot of shots of the audience or like giant concert halls or anything like that. Like, those are all filmed fairly close up. But for what it is, I mean, it's kind of an epic movie. And that's another thing that I don't think we'd really seen from him at this point. And like, everything he had done to this point was so self-contained, right? Like, Dark Star took place on board one spaceship. Halloween is a small town. Precinct 13 is mostly set in Precinct 13, and Someone's Watching Me is a very confined space kind of movie, mostly taking place in an apartment. This one's all over the place. We're in Mississippi, we're in Nashville, we go to Germany.
Yes,
you know, I mean, it's got a real scope to it.
Wow, those are all excellent points. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually looking right here. You're absolutely right. It says Carpenter says the film involved 150 locations and was shot in 30 days. How's that even possible? I mean,
see, I don't know how much you've been behind the scenes on films and documentaries and stuff like that, but like, I've spent a little bit of time and I've done some work in that area myself, and it's just, you know, every time I do it, like, you get to the end of a 14-hour day when you're on a set and it's just like, all right, I'm so burned out. You know, I've never made anything and I've never spent like, you know, more than a week or something working on a project. But I mean, 30 days of just like rushing from location to location. There's like these, you know, the costuming and production design in this movie is really, really good. I mean, you get all the iconic Elvis outfits and all of that. And, you know, just the clothes changes behind the scenes for Kurt Russell must have been really just a real struggle.
Yeah. One thing we should mention here is that, and I just want to get this out of the way, is one thing that sort of bothers me about the picture is you've got Kurt Russell just embodying Elvis Presley, right? To the point where it reminds me of some other really accurate portrayals that I think deserve credibility just for how stunningly on point they are. Like, I have to bring up like Val Kilmer in The Doors, right?
Yeah, sure.
Like, I can't not think of that movie when I'm watching this, because Val Kilmer literally is Jim Morrison. Like, the same way that you know, Denzel Washington is Malcolm X in X. If you haven't seen this movie, Kurt Russell is Elvis in this movie, on the same level as the two examples that I just brought up. No question.
It reminded me of maybe 10, 15 years ago when music biopics were like the thing that Hollywood was doing. So we got Ray, we got Walk the Line, and they you know, those films had some really, really good lead performances. You know, Jamie Foxx as Ray Charles.
Unbelievable.
I think back to that all the time, and Walk the Line is a great film with Joaquin Phoenix and I was going to say Renee Zellweger. Who played June Carter Cash in that movie?
I don't know.
Reese Witherspoon.
Sorry. Ah, there you go.
Anyway, you know, I think that's a really juicy thing for an actor to take on. I mean, you get these like iconic musical personalities and anyone would want to play that role. But we got so used to that genre and the way it worked and the sort of rise and fall narrative and all that. And after a while, those movies start to be a little samey. So for me watching this one, I had to like just put myself in the mindset of, okay, it's 1979. We haven't had all of these films yet. So,
right.
It's a little bit more of an original thing to see like a film story about a musical artist's entire life like this. And the question yes. I kept asking myself throughout Elvis, and I want to know your take on this because I kind of came around to it. For a while, I was just kind of wondering, is Kurt Russell a really, really good actor or is he just a good Elvis impersonator? And I think there's a difference there, obviously. But like there's certain scenes here where he's doing very Elvis-y things. You know, the lip curl and, you know, the hip shaking and all that. And he seems to be kind of doing that all the time. So obviously you're going to see that in the concert sequences and the rehearsal sequences, the musical performance sequences. But he's kind of also doing that like at home when he's just talking to his mom or, you know, hanging out with his friends or something like that. And for a while I was like, well, you know, maybe... maybe he ought to turn it off a little bit. Like, I kind of want to see what Elvis behind the scenes was like. But as the film went on, I started to see, you know, almost a thematic thing where Elvis never really does turn it off. And, like, that was a conscious choice on the part of Kurt Russell and John Carpenter to have him sort of always be in that persona because maybe that's what he was actually like. Like maybe when you become that big of a star and you're known for these certain things, that just sort of permeates your entire life. Does that make any sense?
It makes a ton of sense. And I think that's an excellent analysis of my answer to the question is both. I think Kurt Russell is both an excellent actor and an amazing Elvis impersonator. I mean, and the fact that they let his character permeate into the other scenes, it's really kind of outstanding. You know, I mean, think about how bad this movie could have been with the wrong person in there. And I have to say this just out of complete honesty is that I haven't watched a lot of footage of the real Elvis before. And I'm not that familiar with his catalog of music, so I don't really have anything to draw a fair comparison to.
Well, but I mean, it's like a popular consciousness thing, right? Like we all right. grew up, you know, just kind of seeing clips of Elvis on TV. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's what that guy is all about. And for a while, I wasn't sure if this movie was just kind of riffing on that. But I don't know, like I did find some sincerity in that performance. And as it went on, I started to see that that, like I said, it kind of was a choice. Like, yes, he's overdoing it a little bit, but I think, you know, Elvis, like the whole persona is about overdoing it, you know, like, does he need to kind of move around, have that physicality on stage that he does? I mean, I guess so. I mean, I think that's like a huge part of what the appeal was. And that's got to be a hard thing to turn off. And later in the film, as Elvis starts to get older and starts to regret some of his decisions and wants to lead a more normal life, you kind of see that he can't really turn that off and that he's, you know, he's always sort of struggling with the expectation that everyone has of him being this particular kind of guy and having this incredible energy all the time. And he really doesn't get a chance to sort of slow down and tone it down. And he's always kind of at a 10 when he could be at a 5.
Yes. And as you said, at the beginning of the episode, this is a straight up biopic. I mean, we start with Elvis very young, go through, a lot of different segments of his career. And yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm going to bring up The Doors again, just as a reference. I remember a couple years ago, when you and I worked on a podcast called Talking Movies, we covered The Doors. And I remember you saying, man, is Oliver Stone like a Doors fan, or does he like, you know, is he not a fan of Jim Morrison because of the way he's portrayed in that film?
Yeah.
It's really kind of, there's a camouflage to that movie that's weird because, like, he's this big Jim Morrison fan, but kind of portrays him as being this, you know, rowdy, drug abusing, crazy person that no one would want to be around, which I can see how those elements would take some, you know, a portion of the audience and take them out of the movie. I think John Carpenter's portrayal of Elvis in this movie is out of complete admiration, if anything.
Yeah, it's definitely not a warts and all. I mean, they don't gloss right. over certain things, right? Like, I was very surprised. I kind of thought this movie would find a nice way to express the age of Priscilla Presley when they met. And then we get a scene where he's dropping her off at her high school. So they did not shy away from that. I mean, right. yeah, I, in comparison to something like The Doors, which, you know, one of the things that really fascinates me about that movie, I hadn't seen that until we did it for the show. And yeah, like you were saying, Jim Morrison is portrayed as a real sleazebag in that movie. And it's this incredible Val Kilmer performance that sort of makes you love him and hate him at the same time. And I think that was part of the project of that movie. Here, I think, you know, the project or the goal is to generate some sympathy for Elvis. And I think Carpenter obviously has a lot of respect for him and the portrayal of him. You know, he's kind of like a wounded child through this whole movie. You know, he's a guy who attains a great deal of success at a very, very young age, kind of has some rough experiences growing up and is poor and is kind of bullied a little bit at the beginning of the film, like sure. when he's a child and a teenager. And in some sense, he doesn't ever get over any of that stuff. And he's kind of dealing with it through his whole life. And I think Carpenter portrays that very sympathetically. So, you know, I don't know much about Elvis either. I've never been a huge Elvis Presley fan. He was kind of way before my time. But I know it was kind of a troubled and tumultuous life that he had. And we don't see a lot of the bad stuff in this film. I mean, you know, if he was, you know, ever into drugs or anything like that, we don't see much of that. His problem mostly in this movie is just like I was saying, you know, that struggle to be this person who's just this super iconic godlike figure and to balance that with a normal life. You know, I think particularly like the thing that moved me the most in this movie, this is not a perfect movie. I hope we haven't overplayed our hand here by talking this up. I mean, it definitely has its flaws, but
oh yeah,
one of the big strengths of this movie is the relationship between Elvis Presley and his mother Gladys, played by Shelley Winters, who I believe won an Oscar, was nominated for an Oscar for The Poseidon Adventure. And she is just a really, really, really good actress. It's a really well-drawn character. And, you know, according to this film, the most important person in Elvis's life is his mother. And when we lose her about two-thirds of the way through, we definitely see the impact that it has on him. But the scenes between the two of them leading up to that, I found very, very moving. And I thought were an interesting insight into this person. And whether it's true or not, I think it's a great sort of dramatic hook for the movie.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Shelley Winters and the importance of the relationship between Elvis and his mother in this movie. I mean, at one point, when he dyes his hair jet black, he does that in homage to his mother, you know?
Yeah. And that was a little factoid that I didn't know, right? Because Kurt Russell is very, very blondish for like, you know, maybe the first 45 minutes of this movie. And I was like, wow, wasn't Elvis's hair like really black? And, I guess that was just the dye job.
Yeah. No, like, I mean, one thing that I found impressive about this movie is that, first of all, if you're doing a movie about Elvis, you have to come up with music. And, you know, they hired this guy, Ronnie McDowell, who basically recorded a ton of Elvis songs. And, I mean, to me, they sound like Elvis songs. I mean, this guy went into a studio and replicated who knows how many different songs for this movie that they use.
There's so much music here. I mean, I was very surprised they got the rights and had the ability to just include, I mean, there's something like 25, 30 songs in this. And, you know, we don't get like complete performances, but I was very surprised how little Carpenter cut away from some of this music. I mean, you do get some very lengthy musical sequences and they are very good. I mean, you got Kurt Russell kind of doing a very good Elvis on screen, his lip sync. You know, he is not singing, but I feel like his lip syncing is pretty good and fairly convincing through most of the movie. So it's kind of impressive just to get all of that in. I was not expecting quite as much music and just such a deep dive into the Elvis catalog. I mean, you know, there's stuff here that everybody knows. You get Blue Suede Shoes in the climactic sequence. You get Heartbreak Hotel early on. I mean, some of the really popular Elvis songs are here, but then there's also a bunch that I had never heard before. And I thought that was kind of interesting too. I mean, you know, you sort of forget that even an artist as iconic as Elvis had some deep cuts, some songs that like maybe only the fans would know.
Yeah, and you know what else you get in this movie is that sent me so off topic, but I gotta mention it so we don't forget. We get some Charles Cyphers in this movie.
Yes.
And how incredible is that? I mean, this guy, it almost disappoints me. I wish he was in every John Carpenter movie now at this point.
It's nice to see him not playing a cop for once.
Yeah, he's playing a gentleman named Sam Phillips here who runs a recording studio or is some kind of record label person.
Yeah, that's Sun, where Elvis got his start. I mean, I thought he was going to be in the movie a little bit more, but that's just sort of my ignorance to the Elvis Presley story, right? Like, that is where he got his big break, but yeah, I think he left there fairly quickly. So we only get a few scenes with Charles Cyphers smoking in the recording booth, which I love. There's so much smoking in this movie. Everyone is smoking everywhere in John Carpenter's Elvis.
Yes, that's true. And I think that would only fit the time period,
sure.
You know, accurately. But so back to the music a little bit. That is the one thing that bothered me about this movie a little bit, is that the lip syncing, and while taking nothing away from Kurt Russell's transformation into Elvis Presley in this movie, from the not just the dialogue, but the physicality, you know, his movements, his demeanor, it's amazing. But man, the lip syncing in this and the guitar playing is just so off. I mean,
that's a thing you would notice. I mean, I actually didn't think the lip syncing was so bad, but as far as the guitar stuff, I'm like, yeah, that looks good.
Yeah, no,
you
it's
know
way
more about
off.
That than I do.
Yeah, and that's hard to watch. It just, in particularly, bothered me a little bit because it's like Kurt Russell obviously does not know how to play these songs on guitar, or didn't at the time. And I can only imagine how difficult that would be. I mean, on top of shooting, you know, 150 different locations in 30 days and having Ronnie McDowell record like 30 songs for this movie in apparently a very short window of time, having Kurt Russell learn how to actually play these songs, I'm sure was not like a realistic thing that they could do. But it is, as a musician, it is a little hard to watch some of the performance parts because, you know, it's like, it's just not good. As far as I don't think they made much of an effort to be like, hey, you know, let's make it look like you're at least in the ballpark as far as realistically playing the guitar. The lip syncing's fine, I think. But there's a really strange shot at the very beginning of the movie where when Elvis is very young and they're sitting on the porch, he's on the porch with his parents and some other folks that are friends, I guess, and they sing this really dark song. Do you know what scene I'm talking about here?
Yeah, Nick? Yeah. I actually like that scene a lot. You know, we get a sense there of how his mom was kind of a musical influence on him as well. And these like sing-alongs they'd have at home were meaningful to him. It's a great scene, actually. I love the lighting of that. I love the, you know, it's kind of one of the moments where the movie really slows down and first kind of gives us a sense of what it's going to do later on.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Yeah. I'm not as big a fan of the scene. I mean, I understand what you're talking about, but to me, I'm watching it and I'm just going, I don't know. There's something about it that takes me out of it a little bit as far as, and maybe I'm being too harsh of a critic here. I mean, I can appreciate it, but it's difficult to watch something that's being imitated when it's just clearly not the real thing. And that's the only thing, other than maybe the running time, that bothers me about this movie. Because otherwise, I appreciate it, and I'm kind of a fan of it. Like, if someone were to ask me, hey, you know, would you recommend this movie to somebody? There are several sequences in this movie that I think are done excellently. Let me ask you this, Nick. I'm just going to put you on the spot right now. Do you have a favorite scene in this movie, or is there a scene that sticks out to you that you thought was in particularly dramatic or memorable? Or, I mean, was there a point in the film where you just had to pause it and say, oh my God, like, what am I watching right now? Sort of, I don't know.
No, I mean, I was kind of at like a 5 or a 6 throughout this, and occasionally a little bit better than that. I mean, it's not the most dramatically complex movie. I mean, if you've ever seen any kind of biopic before, and I know this came out before a lot of the ones that we're maybe more familiar with, but, you know, it kind of just hits the same beats that you would expect it to and doesn't do anything particularly surprising. But there are definitely moments that, you know, like I said, a lot of the scenes between Kurt Russell and Shelley Winters I thought were very, very good. You know, some of it is that very old-fashioned, like, here's how you show how a person is sick in a movie, you know, and they're like coughing in one scene and they're in the hospital the scene later. I mean, it doesn't avoid some of those dramatic cliches, but I think her performance and his performance are really, really good. And, you know, there's just some moments like when he's in the army and he has the trailer and she's living with him. Like, his mom is, you know, she's just so doting and she's so sweet to him. And she's trying to do something for him, even though she knows that she's not well and she doesn't want to tell him that. And I thought a lot of those kind of more intimate scenes between him and his mother were really good. And some of the performances were just... You know, they are just really mesmerizing scenes, and I think Carpenter shoots them really well. We get a lot of long takes. We got like the cinematography in this film very often. I think it's a good looking movie. I mean, it's shot on film. It was released in theaters overseas. I guess that was just kind of the practice at the time for TV movies like this. But this doesn't scream TV to me in a lot of ways. You know, we're talking about Someone's Watching Me, and one of the things that took me out of that movie is there was some very TV style camera work in that. Like these zooms up to a character's face and stuff. This one is not like that. This one is a lot more cinematic. So when you get a moment like early on when he's in high school and he does that song at the talent show, and we get these just kind
scene.
Of great like low angle, long takes of young Elvis Presley. How old was Kurt Russell when he made this movie? I mean, he's got to be early 20s here, right?
You put me on the spot. I'm going to go ahead and say, yeah, what was he, probably 24 or something? I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, he's not unconvincing as a high school student, and the sort of vulnerability he shows in that moment, like Elvis is not as sure of himself in the beginning of this film. I mean, the progression of his confidence, I think, is captured really well here. And I really liked that scene. You know, he's this kind of bullied kid and he's really good at this one thing. And he gets up on stage and he just like knocks it out of the park. He sings this sad song about a dog, which kind of had me going like just from I'd never heard that song before. I think it's called Old Shep. And just everything about that scene really worked for me and really kind of showed what was so great about him. And, you know, how people could see that talent at such a young age. According to the IMDb trivia, that scene was pretty well fabricated. That talent show happened when he was much younger and in a different place. And, you know, this sort of very cynical IMDb trivia entry says he placed 5th, not 1st. But in the movie, he just walks away with this talent show. And I think it's just a very effective scene. I mean, I would say all of the performance stuff. There's a great one later on, very, very late in the movie, where he is recording that I don't know the name of the song, that Caught in a Trap song. Maybe that's what it's called. Again, ignorance of all.
When he's recording at his house?
Yeah. And he's got like the entire band there and he's got this group of backup singers and they're all just kind of jamming out on this song. That's a really nice scene also. And then, of course, his wife walks in like, what are you doing here? He's been kind of neglecting her for a long time. And we start to see the dissolution of that relationship there. I mean, there are very, very good scenes in this movie. There's a lot of abbreviations and kind of rushed things. I mean, it is a 3-hour movie, but you're covering like 4 decades in this guy's life. So some things are going to have to happen a lot more quickly than you might expect them to. And scenes are dramatically compressed in a lot of ways, and sometimes that's clunky, sometimes the drama doesn't really work, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, we just need to get them from this point to this point. But you know, I think the movie is best when it slows down for those sequences. There's a great moment where he's just sitting at the piano, and he and his wife have become estranged. She has a young daughter, Lisa Marie, who we know later on went to marry Michael Jackson and shack up with Nicolas Cage. We don't get any of that in this film, but you know, seeing that little kid and knowing who that character is and where her life is going to go, you know, I guess that was a little cringy. But there's this great scene where she kind of walks in and he's like, you know, come sing with me at the piano, and they do that, and I thought that was a nice, sweet little familial moment there. So yeah, I mean, at like every 10 minutes or so, there was another thing in this movie that just kind of drew me in a little bit and got me past some of the rougher patches of it. But you know, it's not perfect. I think the more a fan you are of Elvis, the more you're going to enjoy it.
Possibly, or the more you know about Elvis, you might be disappointed by, because again, accuracy is key here when it comes to biopics, and I don't know much about Elvis at all. I mean, this movie to me is the most education I've ever gotten on Elvis Presley, really.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
To point out, Kurt Russell was 28 when this came out. That's interesting. His middle name is Vogel.
His dad Vogel is in Russell. This movie also. Bing Russell plays Elvis's father. So
his
some
father,
of those scenes
right.
are actually pretty good, too.
Yes. So I have a scene in particular that I want to talk about that I love. So after Elvis hooks up with Sam Phillips, who's, again, played by Charles Cyphers, the great Charles Cyphers, he takes him to an audition, and that's the scene where he's basically playing to an empty theater except for Sam Phillips and this other agent.
Yeah, so this is his Grand Ole Opry audition. So he goes to Nashville, like the,
oh, that's what it is.
The heart of country music, and could be a really big break for him. That is a good scene. Forgot about that one.
Yeah, and he plays the song Blue, is it Blue Moon Over Kentucky? I don't know if that's the title of it, but that's definitely in the hook of the song, is the Blue Moon Over Kentucky. And Carpenter allows the band to play like the full song through. So the camera's kind of panning back and forth between Elvis and his band on stage and Sam Phillips and the Nashville guy, we'll call him. I don't know who he is. And you don't know what the response is going to be, but as a viewer, I'm going, man, they killed that song, right? Like, and he does the whole routine on stage with the dancing and everything. It's great. And then when the song's over, there's kind of this awkward moment of silence. And Elvis just says into the microphone, hey, so what did you think? And our Nashville guy is rather unimpressed, and he says something to the effect of, I think you should stick to driving trucks or
yeah,
something like that.
Absolutely trashes him. And, you know, thinking back to that scene, it's maybe one of Kurt Russell's most moving moments in the entire film, right? Like, because he gets this harsh criticism from this Grand Ole Opry director, whoever he is, and kind of like smiles, almost laughs it off for a second, and then flips out and just like walks off the stage. And kind of seeing that change in his demeanor in that one moment there, like, you know, I think he was expecting he was going to get rave reviews for that performance. And the guy just basically completely trashes everything that he's done and everything that he's about. And, you know, you think he's going to take it in stride, and then he totally doesn't. And I thought that was an interesting choice and a really just powerful moment.
Yes. And what... He ends up storming off the stage, going backstage into a restroom and smashing his guitar out of frustration.
Yeah.
And as a guitarist, it always hurts me to see somebody smash a guitar in any way, shape, or form. I mean, it's just something I could never do.
That's like dogs in movies for me. So when I see a dog die in a movie, it really, really upsets me. For you, it's anytime someone smashes a nice guitar.
I'm like, dude, no, 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 no. And then, you know, because you know he's going to do it. I don't know. Like, that, like it's telegraphed very well where, like, you just know he's going to smash his guitar. And he does. And I know, man, we keep bringing up this film on the show, but I couldn't help but think of The Hateful Eight, man. I was like, wow. I mean, just to be fair, can you think of another actor that has had more than one scene smashing a guitar in a movie?
I mean, not off the top of my head, there probably is one, but
maybe, but there is, but I would love to know who it is, because I couldn't help but think of the scene in The Hateful Eight where Kurt Russell snatches the guitar away from Jennifer Jason Leigh, and tragically, as many of our listeners might know, that was an actual priceless, period correct, vintage Martin acoustic guitar that was shattered accidentally in The Hateful Eight, but nonetheless a powerful scene. I couldn't help but think about the connection between The Thing and The Hateful Eight, and then watching Elvis and seeing Kurt Russell smash a guitar. Quentin, is there a connection there? Or just coincidence?
Oh, man, I would assume there is a connection there. So Quentin Tarantino, of course, famously played an Elvis impersonator on the Golden Girls, like in the late 80s.
And, oh, my God, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can. There's like an episode of the Golden Girls where there's a bunch of Elvis impersonators that I think come to the house, and he is one of them. It was just like this early acting gig that he got. And we know he's a Kurt Russell fan. We know he's an Elvis fan. I'm sure he's very, very familiar with this movie. He probably has the most pristine original print of John Carpenter's Elvis that anyone could possibly own. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, it's like Quentin Tarantino is that guy that just sort of draws on everything. And definitely I would expect that he is a fan of this movie, or at least has seen and familiarized himself with this movie. But yeah, like, so that scene at the Grand Ole Opry also kind of really reinforces the other, like, internal conflict that Elvis goes through over the course of this film. I mean, you know, these music biopics, they have to do this thing where it's like, all right, this is a movie, so you have to have some kind of traditional character arc. So it's like, what is the one specific thing that this character is struggling with? I mean, if you've ever taken a screenwriting class, you know, they talk about sort of external needs and internal needs and how you have to sort of carry those over throughout the film, and you don't want to confuse that. You don't want to muddle that. I mean, people are complex. We're all dealing with multiple things at any given time. But in a movie, you have to sort of streamline that. So one thing that Elvis faces is, like I was saying earlier, he has this inability to, I guess, deal with the death of his twin brother and to deal with the loss of his childhood and stuff like that. And the other thing is, he really doesn't like being told what to do. And he really doesn't like when people sort of criticize his music or change his music. Like, there's a scene later on where he hears a song of his on the radio and he says the vocals are turned up too high and you can't hear the backup singers that he hired. And he gets really, really mad about that. Like, I think he breaks some furniture or something.
I can relate.
See this really neatly set up in that scene, right? Like, this idea that that he can't take criticism, and that, you know, he is confident in his abilities, but he doesn't like when people are sort of demeaning what he does or taking away from what he does, and has a real struggle with that. I mean, the opening and closing of this film, like, we open on like a flash forward, and it's 1969, and he hasn't performed in a long time. So Elvis gets this gig at the International Hotel in Vegas, and I guess this was a major performance in Elvis's career. And leading up to that, we see him just sort of sitting in a hotel room and, you know, having this real moment of crisis where he's like, you know, am I still going to be good enough? And can I still do this? And, you know, what am I doing here? And he pulls out a revolver and shoots the TV in the room when it plays a report about him. You know, it's kind of an intense portrayal of internal struggle. And this guy who's kind of, you know, he's the king of rock and roll. He's on the top of the world. And we see him in a real vulnerable moment there. So that's the other dramatic thread that runs through this film is Elvis versus kind of opinions, and Elvis versus the way people view him and how he wants to be seen.
Yes, all of that is true. And yeah, shooting the television. He must have been one of the first people to ever do that, I guess.
Right, in every music video ever made, someone blows a hole in a television like that.
Yeah, and I mean, this as you said, there are some, like, every movie has to have some kind of arc, some kind of, you know, the character development that we have here is certainly, he seems, I don't want to say anti-authoritarian, but he's maybe just, you know, not a fan of authority, not a fan of criticism. And, I mean, it's pretty ridiculous to see the background that he comes from and this just catastrophic rise to fame, right? And I think that is another thing that the movie does a pretty good job of doing, is just, you know, it's like being a star athlete, or basically having no audience, going from having no audience to being this like massive superstar, and how you deal with that success.
Absolutely. And it's funny that you mention a star athlete, because that's kind of what I was thinking through this entire thing. Like, you know, these young NFL players, they're just out of college, or even some of them skip college, essentially go into the National Football League and make all this money right away. And you see a lot of that in this movie, right? Like, he buys his mom a Cadillac, and you know, he buys this big house. He's like, you know, I kind of come from nothing, so I want to give back to my family. And he is very gregarious about that. But, like, you know, one of the things that's fascinating about the Shelley Winters character as Gladys Presley is that she doesn't really want any of that stuff. You know, like, she's not that she's happy being poor, but you know, she sort of understands the trappings of all that. And she understands what comes with that amount of money and that kind of fame. And she kind of tries to warn him against that. And him just being a young, impulsive guy, like we've seen, you know, so many young athletes and musicians and stuff like that, they do have these like very, very quick rises to power and popularity and wealth. And a lot of them blow their money really early on, and it's not just always a selfish thing. Sometimes it's like, well, you know, I want to give back to my family and I want to provide for them. There's a really, really sad scene. You're mentioning favorite scenes. So he buys his mom this beautiful pink Cadillac. The cars in this movie are fantastic. The cars and the clothes, the production design here is really, really good. And later on, after she has passed, there's a scene, it's a very, very brief moment, where he's in this garage at Graceland, and the car is there, and the chrome is all faded, and you know, the car doesn't have the shine that it had, and his mom is gone, and he just kind of takes a look at it, and it's just this really nice visual reminder of how important she was to him, and how deep the connection between him and his mother were, and that really moved me also.
Yes, that scene is pretty good. I mean, he is, his mother is everything to him. And it does show some of their economic struggles early on. You know, there's a scene early on in the movie where they're like straight up getting evicted from their property, which is reminding me something you just mentioned before, which is really kind of interesting, how Kurt Russell's father is cast as Elvis's father in this movie. I was just reading here. This is interesting that so Kurt Russell would actually go on to get married to Susan Hubley for a couple of years after this movie. Wait a minute. Did she play Priscilla?
She was Priscilla Presley, yeah, and she's very, very good in this movie. I think I had heard that name before, but I didn't really know much about her or what she had done. And this was kind of like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this was kind of her big debut, and like maybe the biggest project she ever did as an actress, which is interesting. I would have expected her to go on to bigger things after this.
Man, I'm looking at Wikipedia saying that the budget for this was between $2 and $4 million. And if that's true, this is by far the biggest budget that Carpenter's had to work with yet.
Well, I mean, it's the biggest movie. Like, just the jumps between times and the jumps between location here. I mean, like I said, like, the performance sequences, you don't get these, like, crazy crowd shots, right? But, like, every place that Elvis performs in looks different. Every time he's with the band, they're, you know, wearing different costumes, and they sort of have different equipment. Like, they do a really good job of making it feel like this is taking place over a large span of time and a lot of different types of places. And I was kind of impressed by that. Like I said before, the sweep of this movie, you know, even early on when his mom moves into Graceland with him and decorates the place for Christmas, I was like, wow, that must have taken a while just to set that up for the film and everything. So, you know, as fast as they worked and as limited, I mean, that's a lot of money, but to make a movie that's 3 hours long and to do what they were doing here, you know, they were basically on a tight budget still. But, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons why you hire Carpenter for something like this, because, you know, he's a guy who can get it done under budget and on time, and he's used to working quickly. So I think if you put this in the hands of a more extravagant kind of director who really wants to make this that big Hollywood epic that it could be, you know, it never gets done, or it gets done for like 10 times the budget that you want it to get done for.
Yeah. And I think that ultimately, I mean, this movie, looking at John Carpenter's body of work, this is an important film for a number of different reasons. And I mean, probably the most important, aside from just gaining more experience as a filmmaker, right? You know what I mean? And adding something into your resume that's outside of the horror genre. But I mean, we're going to be talking about a lot of Kurt Russell on this show. I mean, he's going to show up again and again and again. In particularly on the escape movies and The Thing. And of course, Big Trouble in Little China. So one cannot talk about one without talking about the other. And I would love to know kind of more of the background of how he was cast for this and how their relationship kind of started, because it's kind of like, you know, Scorsese would end up doing with De Niro. Or DiCaprio, even.
Yeah.
Where we have these relationships where it's just like, hey, man, like, I'm making another movie. Do you want to be Snake Bliskin this time? Or, you know what I mean? And I find that it's very interesting how this movie is essentially like the origin of that relationship that would end up happening in cinema.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, what I take away from this movie more than anything else is just this incredible charisma that Kurt Russell has as Elvis. And, you know, like I said before, like, is he overdoing it or is this a good performance? And I kind of lean toward the second thing. I do think this is a good performance. I think the only way to play Elvis is to overdo it, like I was saying. But I mean, there are moments like Carpenter's camera just loves him, right? Like, he's center frame in a lot of these musical performance sequences and just kind of like performing right to the camera and just giving it 110%. And I think as a director, you see something like that and it's like, yes, like, this guy has screen presence. And that's, you know, not every actor, not even some good actors, right? Even some actors that can deliver a really emotionally moving performance, they don't have that charisma and they don't have that screen presence that Kurt Russell has here. But I mean, you look at this guy in this film and it's like, yes, that is a movie star. Like, I want to put him in an action film. I want to make him the center of something bigger than this, right? Something where he gets to really show off like his range and just sort of this magnetism that he has. So, you know, I think over the course of those very, very short 30 days shooting this, I'm sure Carpenter, you know, the wheels are turning there. Like, yeah, this is a guy I want to work with again. Like, this is a guy I want to make a star. I mean, Kurt Russell was not an inexperienced actor
right
by the time Elvis comes around. And, like, he had kind of a whole history. He was actually, as a child actor, he co-starred or did a supporting role in an Elvis movie, which was pretty cool. So he kind of had this Elvis affinity his entire life. We also mentioned on the show later on, he played an Elvis impersonator in 3,000 Miles to Graceland, which is not a good movie, but it's a very, very fun movie and you should check it out, particularly if you're a Kurt Russell fan. But, you know, I mean, this is like such a go for broke performance. And I think as a director, you see something like this and it's like, yes, I want more of this, because ultimately, you know, sometimes actors do sell movies. And I can't see something like Escape from New York or Big Trouble in Little China without this really outsized, charismatic, just really likable presence as it's at its center. And I think if you cast anybody else in those movies don't work. You know, Kurt Russell is Snake Plissken. Kurt Russell is Jack Burton. I mean, The Thing, I think you could probably get away with somebody else because just what the nature of that movie is. But he's great in that film, too. I think you, like, once you've played Elvis, once you've kind of gone out and done this this huge role like this, then the sky is the limit, you know? Like, where do you take that from here? How can you translate that screen presence to other types of stories that are maybe not the, you know, not about iconic characters the way this one is?
All valid points. And this wraps up, I mean, this wraps up the 70s for John Carpenter, which... being the beginning of his career, if looking back, I mean, a very successful start for him, right? I mean, you have getting your foot in the door with Assault on Precinct 13, you know, getting some accolades, more particularly overseas. You know, Dark Star is what it is. You know, that would end up becoming more of a recognized and cult classic film over time, but at this point, Halloween is on fire, and getting the recognition of being one of the game-changing slasher movies. Someone's Watching Me, probably not a lot of people saw, but was received well. And then Elvis comes out, and I mean, we're talking Golden Globe nominations here. I mean, things that Carpenter is like never going to be affiliated with again throughout his career.
Yeah, he's really on the upswing here. And the thing is, yeah. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, someone in 1979, it's a couple years after Elvis Presley has passed away. He still has this huge fan base. This has to be like such a major TV event, you know, like this is the kind of thing that you read about months before it comes out. And like, I could just imagine America just like popping some popcorn and sitting in front of the TV and being really, really hyped up for this Elvis movie. I mean, I don't know, like, I didn't see the viewership numbers for it anywhere, but, like, this had to be, like, such a high-profile project. This had to be such a good get for him as a director, and, you know, like I was saying with Kurt Russell, like, once you do this, you can kind of do anything that you want, you know, like, particularly if it's well-received, and this obviously was. It got the awards attention and all of that, so, you know, this is a major step in his career for a number of reasons. It really makes me wonder, right? I mean, he does a pretty good job with this. He handles the dramatic scenes pretty well. Like, this might be the only Carpenter film that's not a genre film, right? That, like, has no horror elements or sci-fi elements or action sort of stuff going on. He never does this again. He never makes another film about music again. And I sort of have to wonder why, because, you know, I wouldn't say he completely knocks it out of the park here. I wouldn't say this is one of his best films, but there's nothing particularly wrong with it. You know, I think his contributions to it are mostly pretty good, and you know, I don't know what it is. Maybe he just doesn't like to do these expansive stories. Maybe he does like to do more self-contained kind of things. You know, you go from here to The Fog, which is a movie that takes place entirely in this very isolated small community. And then you got The Thing, which is a really, really isolated setting and has a very, very consistent style all the way through. Here, you're talking about like different eras in American history, and they all kind of have to look the way they do to reflect those eras. So, you know, maybe he's just not one of those directors who likes to do that, right? Like a Scorsese or a Spielberg, who it's like, let's go, you know, huge as far as we can and cover lots of time and cover lots of ground. I think Carpenter is more of a small scale kind of guy.
Yeah, it's as I pointed out at the beginning of the show, it sticks out. I mean, if you just look at a list of all his movies, you go, what? Like, it's like Halloween, Elvis, The Fog. You know, I mean, it's really it really stands out as being, I mean, like you were saying, he really never goes back into this territory with filmmaking. I'd like to point out here, again, courtesy of Wikipedia, under the reception section here. Yeah, I mean, it says, so Elvis originally aired on ABC opposite two blockbuster films, Gone with the Wind on CBS and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on NBC. I mean, those are two classic films. And apparently, according to Wikipedia, despite this, Elvis beat both in the Nielsen ratings, receiving a 27.3 rating compared to 24.3 and 22.5 respectively. Elvis was ranked the sixth most watched program of the week. So when you were mentioning before, you know, America, like at home in front of their TVs watching this movie, yeah, I think this was sort of an event, you know, and it was before our time, so we can't really speak from our own experiences, but yeah, this is a very interesting. I've been thinking about doing this. I knew eventually we were going to get to this movie, and I'm so glad that we were able to finally talk about it, because I just, if I have a conversation with anybody about John Carpenter, it's, if this movie ever comes up, the response is always, what?
Like, he made an that? Elvis movie? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, he's kind of still just starting off his career here, but he's trying all kinds of different things, right? I mean, he doesn't become known as a master of horror, quote unquote, till much, much later on. And at the beginning, it's like there's so many different directions he could go in. And, you know, Dark Star is such a different film from a lot of the stuff he did later on. And Starman, that comes a few years after this, is wildly different from a lot of other things he did. So, you know, it's almost like he's just kind of feeling stuff out, and he's trying to figure out who he is as a filmmaker, and finding his voice, and is brave enough to try things that are a little bit outside his comfort zone. I mean, this is a huge step outside of everything that he had done up to this point.
Yeah, and we are literally about to embark on, like, the Renaissance period, if you will.
We are. The 1980s were a very good decade for John Carpenter. So,
yeah.
You know, as strongly as he ended the 70s here, kind of pales in comparison to what came later. But, you know, that's another topic for another day. What is the next movie we'll be discussing on the show, Chris?
Well, you just kind of spoiled it a moment ago, but...
Oh, yes, I did.
No, the next film that we're doing is The Fog, which would come out the following year in 1980. And I have to admit, was a movie I had never seen. I saw The Fog for the first time, I think... couldn't have been much more than a year ago. So it was a movie that had gotten outside of my attention span for my entire life. And it's going to be a return to what I think John Carpenter is known for. You know, this is...
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the true follow-up to Halloween, right?
Right.
Like, you can't look
right.
at Halloween then Elvis and draw any kind of linkage there, but he does kind of quickly go back to that mode he was working before. I mean, just think about how prolific this guy is, though, right? He's got two movies that come
it's
out
insane.
In 1978, this three-hour epic that comes out in 1979, and then he goes on to do The Fog, which, you know, like I said, it's a fairly small movie, but it is a feature film and you know, isn't like a minimalist thing, so... he is a real workhorse. He is a guy who definitely likes making movies and wants to just get out there and keep doing it and doesn't like to wait between projects at all, really.
Yep, very true. And I admire that kind of consistency and that kind of just work ethic. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, he's young and hungry at this point and just kind of wants to prove to Hollywood and to the world what he's capable of.
Well, Nick, I think we've done a pretty good job of covering Elvis here.
Are you saying that Elvis has left the building?
Elvis has left the building, right. I will, and again, I will leave it on this. It's a long movie, but if your curiosity takes you there, I would say go ahead and watch it, if nothing else other than Kurt Russell's amazing performance.
Yeah, I mean, you got to see where this relationship began, and I do think, you know, he really holds your attention in this film, and if you like him, you're going to love him as Elvis.
Correct. Correctamundo.
All right, so with that, I think we will head on out of here and go watch The Fog. And so you said you had seen it for the first time a year ago. I saw it for the first time at Halloween night this year, so it's like just over a month for me, and I'm looking forward to watching it again, and I'm sorry that I waited so long into my life before I caught that very important film in the Carpenter filmography. But
yes.
We would love to hear back from all of you about what you would like to hear on the show, how we're doing. Again, I keep saying this, but we still have a really long way to go. And as Chris was just mentioning, we're getting into some of the most important films and maybe the most important decade of Carpenter's career. So big things ahead to discuss on the show. But until then, if you'd like to get a hold of us, you can reach us via email at precinct13podcast@gmail.com. gmail.com. We are on Twitter at 13precinct, facebook.com/13precinct, and our website where you can download all of our episodes, find all of the subscription links to the show so you can subscribe and be on board for all those episodes coming up is precinct13.simplecast.com. We will talk to you again soon for our discussion of The Fog. Have a great couple of weeks until then.